In the years after slavery was abolished, many in the South scrambled to find cheap labor. To compensate, states from Maryland to Alabama and Florida began the practice of convict leasing. Toward the end of the 19th century and in the early decades of the 20th century, southern states leased prisoners to mining operations, farms, and companies building the railroad. The deal was a moneymaker for the states, local law enforcement officials, and the companies. Many southern states ended the practice by the beginning of the 1900s, but it continued in Alabama until 1928. Doug Blackman has investigated convict leasing for the Wall Street Journal. He says that in the beginning, many black prisoners were simply sent back to the farms on which they had worked as slaves.
By the time you get a little ways into the 20th century, this has essentially become a labor practice to provide workers for very large-scale, massive coal mining operations, and to a lesser degree, lumbering operations in the swamps of South Alabama and Florida.
Were white prisoners not also leased out?
There were. We've pieced back together those records that exist, and generally the population of those who were sent into labor ran about 85% to 95% black.
And this was all legal?
It was, and particularly in its last decades, it was a highly organized, in some respects, closely documented system. And in fact, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery in 1865, has a provision that allows for the involuntary servitude of duly convicted prisoners. The question that sort of haunts all of this, though, is the fairly overwhelming evidence that there were many thousands of individuals pressed into labor through this practice who had been arrested on trivial or almost non-existent kinds of charges. And it's also very clear as you reconstruct this that there were profound financial incentives that had been created which fed this system so that county sheriffs and other local officials made a great deal of money personally off fulfilling these labor contracts for the private companies that were involved.
So you could end up doing hard labor even if you hadn't committed a crime that would seem to merit that.
A very common circumstance involving thousands and thousands of individuals that we found was, for instance, a young black man would be arrested and charged with vagrancy, which is the crime of not having a job, or gaming, which would essentially be being at the site of a dice game on a Sunday in a black community, something like that, within a day or two, fairly summary judgment, they'd be convicted of the crime, fined $5 or $10 by a judge, which was a fairly substantial sum in, say, 1908. And most of these individuals in that period of time couldn't pay a $5 or $10 fine to begin with, and so they would be sentenced to be leased to a company, and then the fine would be paid out of the proceeds of the lease. But what became most dramatic was that in addition to the fines, these individuals had to pay a variety of fees, a fee to the sheriff, a fee to the witnesses who testified against them, a fee to the deputy sheriff who brought them in, a fee to a court clerk. And those fees would add up to a much larger sum. And in the end, many, many hundreds of people in the end were sentenced to terms of a year or 2 years of hard labor in a coal mine for a crime like vagrancy.
This leasing, was this a good revenue producer for the states?
It was a tremendous revenue producer, particularly in Alabama. We've gone back and calculated, and in the period for which records can be reconstructed, between about the turn of the century and 1920, this was not the majority, but it was often one of, if not the largest source of funds that the state had.
Are any of these companies still in existence?
Many of them are. There were dozens of American companies who participated in the practice, dozens just in Alabama. If you extend it across all the southern states, there may well have been hundreds. We focused on Alabama because the practice lasted so long there. And of those, many, many of these companies survive today in one form or another. One of them that is still today and existed as the same entity at the time this was happening was U.S. Steel Corporation, which purchased an Alabama company in 1907 that was engaged in this practice and merged with the company and made it a subsidiary and then continued with the practice of convict leasing for a number of years after that. But there are also other companies that have a less direct lineage, companies like a New York Stock Exchange traded company called Walter Industries, which has a number of different industrial units, and one being Jim Walter Homes. But one of its units is called Sloss Industries, and that's a descendant over the course of a couple of mergers from another of the heaviest users of convict laborers at the turn of the century.
You got all this from public records. I wonder if the companies have kept any records on this use of leased prisoners.
For the most part, the companies that I've talked to are as unaware of this history as anyone else, and they reacted with surprise that this was in their past. In the case of U.S. Steel, they went back into their records and were helpful to a degree in trying to determine what documentation there was. They found very, very little. One memo from 1913 that referenced this practice, a map of a particular site that had a notation on it, those kinds of things. I haven't been able to discover much in the way of actual corporate records. What might be out there elsewhere is hard to know.
It's ugly, but it doesn't seem too surprising, is it, considering that rehabilitation is a more modern concept of prisons?
Well, I think that's true. It's also true, though, that there was an active debate even at this point in time about whether this was a good idea. Even among Alabamans, there was an active discussion among the political leaders about whether this ought to be happening, whether or not this amounted to a cruel regime, and also very specifically about whether there were large numbers of people ending up in the mines solely because of the financial incentives that had been created for local officials. And so, on the one hand, the system is a cruder form, perhaps, of privatized penal systems of today, but that may gloss over the depth of the mistreatment of individuals which occurred, which was really extraordinarily severe. And the conditions that existed in these prison mines, as described in these documents from that period, were brutal, is something of an understatement.
Tell me how you found out about this.
I ran across a reference while working on a different story a year or so ago about convict leasing, and at the time the German slave labor questions and lawsuits were heating up, and I got a bit curious about whether there might be living American corporations that had connected back to some sort of even roughly parallel kind of past, and so it developed from there.
Very good, thanks.
Thank you.
Doug Blackman is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.